Typhoon, the inside story of an RAF fighter squadron at war, is the new compelling book from Wing Commander Mike Sutton. Taking command of the RAF's premier Typhoon squadron represented the pinnacle of Mike's career as a fighter pilot, until he was told he would be leading one fighter squadron into battle against a bloody and brutal enemy, hell-bent on establishing a permanent stronghold across Syria and Iraq. What happens next is tackled in the book Typhoon by Wing Commander Mike Sutton. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. Mike himself. Mike, good morning to you.
Hi, Charles. Thanks very much indeed for having me on the show.
The pleasure is indeed mine. Now, for those of us who perhaps got as far as Airfix models in our understanding of aircraft and military hardware, what makes the Typhoon such a special aircraft?
The Typhoon's an absolutely fantastic, modern, multi-role aircraft. Hugely manoeuvrable, hugely powerful, and it's capable of air defence missions, so protecting the skies, as well as air-to-ground, where it's supporting the soldiers. And it can flick seamlessly between those two mission sets.
Is that one of the things that you demand in a modern military aircraft, the fact that it's no longer just a role that, you know, you do one thing, be it reconnaissance, or you do one thing being a bomber, or one thing being a fighter. And you know, we've got one which is good for desert, one which is good for more conventional sort of Western European sort of theatres of war. And the thing about the Typhoon is it is so multi sort of tasking in its capabilities.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's a hugely manoeuvrable aircraft. And it can be used in a variety of different scenarios, as I described, and also in reconnaissance and that sort of thing as well. Flying it was, you know, it was an absolute dream. I flew the Jaguar before, which was a little bit older in the tooth. And then moving on to the Typhoon, which is this, you know, I guess describing it somewhere between a Formula One car and a rocket ship. And you'd pass yourself into the cockpit of this thing and launch down the runway, get up to about 180 miles an hour, and then having reached that speed, you then put it on its tail and just blast off into the stars. So the power and the performance of it was incredible. And having a really maneuverable aircraft as well is really important in a combat environment as well. So it's got all that.
And is it just you as the pilot, or do you have a navigator sitting behind you? What's the actual setup? So before we get into the nuts and bolts of the actual the book itself, I mean, is it you on your own? Do you have a crew behind you? How is the sort of the setup in terms of people actually in the aircraft?
It's just you. There's no one else in the airplane at all. So it's just you and some computers, about 7 tons of fuel and a load of weapons. But you often fly in pairs or four ships or even eight ships. So while you feel alone sometimes in the aeroplane, there's often other aircraft around in what we call a formation. And when we were over in Iraq and Syria, we'd normally fly around as pairs. So you'd have a wingman and you could work together on tasks as well.
So tell me a little bit about then your deployment to the area. Whereabouts were you based, and what was your, if you like, your original mission and how did it come about?
Well, we watched, as you know, in that beautiful introduction that you gave, the kind of horror and atrocity of ISIS storming across the Middle East, and watched it played out on the television screens at the time, and all the associated terror attacks that are happening, you know, in Europe as well, and that awful night in Paris, where a huge number of people were killed, and we're watching this as a high readiness squadron. And the RAF all times has got a squadron ready to go at a moment's notice on operations around the globe. And this happened, and then essentially got a phone call saying there's going to be a vote in Parliament and the UK might be required to go and conduct airstrikes against ISIS targets in Syria as well as Iraq. And if it passes, then you're on. And so we spent an extremely hectic week getting everything together, getting the final preparations set. And then when this vote happens, then we launched it first light the following morning.
I mean, you train, you get ready for these sort of scenarios, but can any sort of preparation get you ready for sort of the real heat of battle, the actual going into hostile airspace?
I think there's two elements to that question. There's a sort of training angle, and then there's the reality of what might happen on the day. And I think taking training first, it's something that the Air Force practices every single day. So it's very mission specific. On a fast jet squadron, you're planning for each sortie, you can take 2 to 3 hours, then go and fly the mission. Then when you come back and debrief it, that takes another 2 or 3 hours as well. Everything in the cockpit is recorded, all the screens are recorded. And then when you get back, the 3 or 4 of you that went flying, 3 or 4 aircraft will sit in the room, you'll play back in real time. Actually, you'll slow the tapes down almost to milliseconds at times, and you'll analyze what everyone else has done in that formation. So there's no hiding in training, which is great. So it's a very open and honest training environment. And then you tailor that training to all the different mission sets that you might have to do. And they range from quick reaction alert, which is defense of the UK airspace, right through to the air-to-ground tasks, doing kind of overwatch and reconnaissance missions and carrying out airstrikes. And it's a routine process that you go through every single day. So you gear yourself up for what could happen. But as everyone knows, events in the world are quite unpredictable. And so you never know exactly where you're going to be used or when. And so come the actual moment, you hope that the preparation's been enough. And in this case, it was. You know, we went out, and within 24 hours of arriving on the ground, we were conducting round-the-clock airstrikes in support of the forces on the ground, the soldiers on the ground who are in trouble, against ISIS targets.
I've got two questions coming up next. I mean, what were you expecting to come up against? Because we know that ISIS obviously didn't have their own aircraft, you know, at this point. So were you obviously especially on the lookout for surface-to-air missiles, you know, handheld, if you like, missiles that they could be taking with them, as well as having emplacements? And how much do you liaise with the ground forces to say, well, look, if you can take out some of the you know, some of the emplacements, then, you know, we got a better chance of delivering of achieving our objective?
It was quite a complex scenario that we got thrown into, because you obviously had ISIS on the ground presenting a threat, and I'll come on to that in a second. But over in the western side of Syria, you also had Russian forces deployed as well, and conducting their own sort of operations. And a week or so after we went out, a Russian jet had actually been shot down at the hands of a Turkish aeroplane. So it was quite a complex strategic environment that we're in. And so we're very aware of sort of miscalculations and unwanted escalation and involvement with the Russians, who had their own aircraft and missile systems. And we tried to sort of stay away really from them. The threat from ISIS was very much surface-to-air missiles, and particularly handheld infrared sort of heat-seeking surface-to-air missiles. And they were something that we're always extremely guarded against.
Well, I mean, can you say to Russian Strategic Command, by the way, we're about to do a sortie into ISIS. Can you please keep the MiGs out of the way, because we're going to be going in about 30 seconds?
Well, I think there was some engagement at the sort of higher headquarters at a strategic level, but that all kind of happened well above the level I was at. We were just interested in doing the best possible job at the time and supporting the troops on the ground. And you mentioned earlier about getting the troops to support the air. It didn't really work like that. It was more the other way around. And so we would be tasked on a what's called a close air support mission, which means that you're going to go and help the troops. You don't really know what that's going to be involved until you get there. And you'd be sitting sometimes on the runway at your base, surrounded by thunderstorms, with an 8-hour mission ahead, and thinking, well, I know I'm going to be going somewhere in Iraq or somewhere in Syria. I don't know what I'm going to be facing when I get out there. And so you'd arrive into the airspace. The first thing we do is fill up with fuel from an air-to-air refueler. And then we'd offer ourselves up to tasking. And then we'd be handed over to some soldiers on the ground based on need. And if there was a troops in contact or some support that they'd need, then you'd hot foot it across there, maybe a couple of hundred miles away, and turn up in the overhead and help them out as best you could.
If you were fighting a conventional enemy, you know, an army who obeyed the laws of the Geneva Convention, you would find that you could sort of think to yourself, well, if the worst happens, at least I'll be treated fairly. And one of the most horrendous things that happened was the shooting down of a Jordanian Air Force pilot and, you know, the barbaric execution of him that they played across the world's media. You know, as a pilot yourself, and as going into ISIS-held territory, was that something that you know, was maybe in the back of your mind as well?
Yeah, absolutely was in the back of your mind. We would train in some survival techniques and escape and evasion techniques, and we had some of that. But yeah, that event with the Jordanian, was everyone was aware of that, and it's just something that you just hoped wouldn't happen to you. And so you'd fly the mission, you'd concentrate on the mission, you'd be as professional as you can. It's hugely absorbing and immersive. And the priority was always to support the soldiers.
When you get into the situation, when you get into doing your mission, I mean, you're saying that, you know, we've got computer screens, we play it all back, you know, you've got the mission statement. It sounds like an insane amount of information, of data, because again, a lot of us will think, well, you just point the jet in the direction, it's a bit like a big Spitfire kind of thing, and off you go and toggle back and all that sort of stuff. But there must be huge amounts of information coming to you, and you're on your own, you haven't got somebody behind you, you know, navigating or whatever. How do you A, process all that information coming in real time, B, get on with the job in hand, and C, because obviously you've trained and you've trained and you've trained, but this is a, as the saying goes, you know, the best made plans go out of the window on first contact with the enemy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in the book, one of the things that I found is when you get back from operations and you talk to people, they're interested, and they ask those sort of questions. They'll say, what was it like? And what were you thinking? And what were you feeling? And that's exactly what I've tried to address. It's to try and bring an insight into that hidden world of exactly all of those issues that you've mentioned, and exactly that. So the book isn't about, you know, it's called Typhoon. It's not a technical book, and it's not a history book about what happened. It touches on that a little bit, but it's to try and bring to life all of the immersive nature of all of those issues, what you're thinking before a strike, how you're feeling about it, what your concerns are, what the risks are, and how you can maybe mitigate some of those. The mechanics of what you're doing when you're conducting an attack, or maybe just doing some reconnaissance of what you're thinking about. And then the aftermath, which is normally you're onto something straight away, a whole new thing. So you'll conduct an attack, you'll record what's happened, that all gets analyzed at home, but you haven't got any time to dwell or contemplate. You're thinking about your fuel, you're thinking about your navigation, there's perhaps another soldier on the radio asking for support, and you're straight off onto that task and thinking about the next scenario.
And the other thing is, you know, you said, you know, you're at your base, you fly, you refuel, and then you say, you know, you are available in the air to help out. You go in, you do your job, you take out your target, and then I'm presumably back, you know, heading back. That's, you know, they always say that, you know, soldiering and any war is long periods of sort of waiting around and then insane intense action, and then you're back to long periods of time as well. That presumably, even in 21st century technological warfare, still applies.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And it's a completely variable tempo. So some trips we go out as two aircraft, and you'd be immediately thrust into the most dynamic and complex situations imaginable, with unmanned air vehicles involved, troops in contact, improvised explosive devices, and you're conducting attack after attack, sometimes 100 miles apart, down in Fallujah, then flying quickly up to Mosul to help some troops up there, then back to Ramadi via the tanker, and that goes on. And then you're flying home after 8 hours, and you're just utterly exhausted by the 8 hours that have happened before that have gone in, and it feels like about 30 minutes.
Because that's
so that happened.
I was going to say, because that, I mean, the other thing is the fact, you know, most people have got closer than I've come is, you know, flying a bleeding video game. But the physical demands, it's like people say, you mentioned driving an F1 car. You know, the physical demand, you're not sitting there in a comfy armchair, you know, fiddling around. I mean, presumably you're, you know, pulling huge amounts of G on the body, and you might have a flight seat to help you with some of the G, but presumably it's a very physical experience as well as being a mental one.
I think it is can be quite physical, and it depends on the mission set that you're doing. If you're just flying from A to B, it is a little bit like an airliner. You're sat there straight and level, and you're not maneuvering the airplane. And that's a time to take a gulp of water and maybe have a quick look at your maps and that sort of thing. When you're involved in something more dynamic, the G-force is incredible. The aeroplane can pull up to 9G. So when you sit in this thing, you're wearing a flying suit. You might be wearing an immersion suit as well to protect you in case you eject into water. Then you're wearing a G trousers and a G suit, which both inflate tightly around your legs and your chest to keep your blood pressure high. And you're also wearing a helmet. You can have a set of night vision goggles strapped onto the front of those too, which is a bit like balancing, you know, kind of half a bag of sugar onto a baseball cap. So it kind of wears on your neck. And the G-force means that your whole body gets heavier when you turn. So the jet can pull up to 9G. If I put that into some sort of perspective, if your head, the average human head weighs about 5, if you've got a helmet on all the rest of it, maybe that's now weighing 7. And if you're pulling 9G, you know, you're timesing that by 9, you're up to 63 kilograms. So your head, just your head, weighs almost 10 times the amount that it does. And so it puts an exertion on your neck and your body. And we go through centrifuge training, which is essentially a giant scaffolding arm. It appeared in the moon in the Bond film Moonraker years ago, but it's a scaffolding arm that whizzes round, and you sit in that thing, and a doctor sits in a console and gives you training about how to cope with the G-forces to stop you from blacking out.
So the book, as you said, it's designed to take, you know, mere mortals like myself into the cockpit. How was it? What was it like to write it and put, you know, your experience and your information so that down on the page or down on the keyboard and the screen?
I've never written a book before, and it didn't start off as a book. I think when we deployed for the first time on that mission, I was very aware that it was quite a unique set of circumstances, and the events were happening so thick and fast. At the end of every day, I just scribbled a few pencil notes into a diary. And then during lockdown, when I had more time, probably like most of the population, more time at home, I thought I'll just get around to writing up these old pencil notes, and just sat down with the computer and started typing away. And then it kind of turned into a book from there, with a bit of encouragement from friends and family.
So what do you hope then that people take from Typhoon? And I mean, this is not a loaded question, but you know, you've been in that theatre, you've seen the effects. You know, it's something you presumably you're proud of, being part of that elite squadron with that aircraft and carrying out those missions.
Hugely proud of what everyone achieved, and it touches on the relationships in the book, the camaraderie on a fast jet squadron, which I think is very similar to a sports team. And indeed, I've taken a lot of parallels when you're on a fighter squadron about some of the sporting concepts like marginal gains and how do you do things better. So it's a story of a team of people that have gone out and done that. And absolutely, it's not just about me. It's about one squadron, and indeed all the Typhoon, you know, pilots that have been involved out there. I hope we'll have a similar experience. And what I've just tried to do is provide the opportunity to bring to light what's essentially a hidden world, and that's something most people won't get the opportunity, you know, to experience, and to strap them into a cockpit, put them over enemy territory, and accelerate them up to Mach 1.8.
Sounds like something that many people wish they did with me on a regular basis, but there you go. The book is called Typhoon. It's by Wing Commander Mike Sutton, who will be speaking today. Mike, if people want to find out more information about you, is there a website? And I know you do a bit of the social media thing as well.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Mike_Sutty. So send me a direct message on that. And the book's available in all good bookshops.
And also as a virtual download from our virtual bookstore. Just a quick question, Mike. Will you be looking forward to the release of Top Gun 2, by the way? Because obviously you've been there, and presumably everybody's thinking, oh, this is going to be, you know, the be-all, end-all of fighter jet movies.
Let's not pretend there's not a human in Europe that's not looking forward to the release of that movie.
Brilliant. Well, the book is called Typhoon. It's by Mike Sutton. Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thanks very much.